Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 63 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weirdbeard, and with me, as always, is my wonderful hostess and producer, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
Yeah, I think you need to add long-suffering hostess. Oh, geez. I don't know if other podcasts do this, but with us, dear listeners, when Weird makes a screw-up, we don't just say, oh, my bad, and go for it again. No, we've got to have a 10 to 15-minute digression, which we will sweep into a blooper reel for you, and you'll get to hear my awesome Honey Badger impression.
That is, it was pretty awesome. I won't lie. Let's not do it again. We gotta save it for the diehard fans. So I said producer because I am currently in Ireland, though at the time of this recording, I'm still here in Massachusetts, but I fly out tomorrow. And Aaron has elected to cut this show together. So it may sound a little bit different from how I do it. And you know what? The episode where my computer blew up and Aaron happened to have a recording of it from her end, and she threw it all together like a boss, sounded a little bit different, but just fine. So I am very, very pleased that you stepped up to the occasion, Aaron.
Like a boss.
Like a boss.
So, yeah, it won't be any worse than the rough cut, and will possibly be better as my skills have improved.
Mm-hmm. So, what is new with you besides being given a new hat?
Well, I don't really want to say that it's official, because I am expecting some degree of, I'm not really sure what the term is. Not bad acting, but all right. Well, I'll tell you what it is. So Operation Blazing Sword has put the money down to have a booth at Orlando Pride. Now, I know a lot of people are confused. They say, well, wait, I thought Pride Month was in June, and well, it is. But for some reason, Orlando does it in mid-October. And the only reason I can think of is because of the heat. And Florida in June is deadly. And so they figured, well, we'll do it in October and it should be cooled off enough. I don't know. So on the one hand, I would like to announce that Operation Blazing Sword and Pink Pistols will have a booth at Pride in October, but I remember what happened the last time I tried to set something up, and they may just decide that I have, and I registered it under Blazing Sword, I didn't register it under Pink Pistols, but they may look me up and they may find that I am related to the G word, and oh no, and they may just, you know, return my money and say, no, you can't join. But hopefully we'll be there.
Hopefully that will not happen, because Operation Blazing Sword and Pink's Pistols is very awesome. And, well, if they keep pushing you away, they can keep you as much of a boogeyman as they want you to be. But if you're actually there, they'll realize that, oh, these people really aren't that scary and mean.
Mm-hmm. So that's really the only big news I have at the moment. Oh, actually, last week I unveiled, and this is another Blazing Sword thing, we completely redid our database. I wrote a blog post about it, there's a lot of reasons, but the short version is that the old database was on a Google map, and that meant Google owned all the information, and it also meant that if they decided they didn't like us, they could kill it at any time. And given the way Google has been acting towards gun content, and for a couple other reasons, we decided that we would transition to a database that we privately owned. So that's what we did, and it took over a month. And we think we got everything ported over correctly, but unfortunately, you know, when you download stuff from Google Maps, sometimes things are scrambled. Like, There was one guy who lives in Alaska, and his location was somewhere in Washington State. So if you were a volunteer, what we ask you to do is go to blazingsword.org and go to the volunteer tab. It's got a drop down that says instructor sign up and update. And so you'll have to create an account. It's very easy. And then you can check your data and you can update it if it's wrong. And if you're not there by some terrible reason, you can add it. So now instead of having to bug us every time you move, you can just log in and do it yourself. And if you decide you don't want to be associated with us, you tell us and we'll delete it. So the big deal here is that you own your data, not Google. And so as
that's
soon as
awesome.
Yeah, and so as soon as we get everyone ported over and everything's running smoothly, we're going to delete the Google map. And so, you know, some of the stuff will exist on a Google server somewhere for however long they keep it, but it won't be searchable by people with bad intentions, which was a concern people had, and we just we accepted it as a necessary evil at the time, but now it's a lot better. And so I encourage everyone to go and update themselves, and it should be a lot better.
Yeah, I'm not so concerned about the searching with bad intentions, though. Of course, there's always that possibility. But with the way Google's been going and other social media types, it's just been the killing the message, just making it disappear again. Like the whole idea of the, let's not have you at Orlando Pride. I mean, I can, hopefully that won't happen, but you're speculating on that. Or just the whole idea of the, when anti-gun groups, like I went to a Moms Demand Action rally when it was in Atlanta, and got myself some really good audio fisc material from that. And it was a fun experience. And since then, every Moms Demand Action has been at every NRA group, but they've been having closed meetings in gun-free zones because they know this is not something that they want. They want to be interacting with. They want their group to be as isolated from us as possible so that they can go, you know what? All this sounds legit versus, hey, but Steve over there is a gun owner. He's not any of this crazy stuff. Hey, I know someone that's got an AR-15. They're not a problem. That is their enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So, Aaron, it's been a little while since we've talked about the NRA.
Yes, I know. I suppose it has.
Yeah, I know. You're not excited about that. Though literally the other day I was actually talking with someone and they're like, why, what's happening with the NRA? So there might be some people that are not following it on their own or have not heard about some of these establishments. And really, I wanted just to talk about it because honestly speaking, it's gone from I was kind of giddy. I mean, we recorded my interactions with it, and it's on Facebook. On, you know, my feelings when essentially the Colonel North letter came out. Mm-hmm. Essentially, really kind of, I mean, it was blackmail. It was the, you know, step down gracefully, or I'm gonna dump a whole lot of unappealing information on you. And
well, let me interrupt you because I don't recall if I ever saw that letter. I only recall seeing what Wayne told us was in the letter.
Oh, that's true. That is true.
And at the time we didn't have reason to doubt him, but as more of the scandal has come to light, and it seems to be a circle of aggrandizement and the Wayne LaPierre Society. Yeah, what he says is, at least for me, becoming more and more suspect.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, at the time we were all, oh wow, and I remember being as giddy as you at the NRA meeting because it seemed like there was going to be another Cincinnati revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And then it didn't happen, and then it's just been a dumpster fire.
Yeah, and really the notion of my giddiness was, I mean, we both openly spoke that we don't have anything personal against Colonel North, but the idea of hiring somebody on as the essentially this face and the spokesman of the NRA, who was involved in essentially gun running to the Iranians. Again, I'll just say involved and not get into all the minutiae, because there's a lot of people that either really, really like Colonel North or don't really like Colonel North. And that is immaterial to my statement. Is just the, I don't think, consider him to be a good choice for the position. So seeing him step down and all that, I was not displeased with that. And I was hoping that Wayne would step down as well. And honestly speaking, at Indianapolis, I was already prepared with like a little kind of working over, what am I going to say? And I really wanted to kind of gloss over a lot of the reasons a lot of the things that have made me unhappy with how Wayne LaPierre has been running the NRA over the last few years, and just start talking about all the good things that he had done leading up to, all the way up to the sunset of the assault weapons ban, and well, them tagging on to Heller versus McDonald, Heller versus DC, and then going straight in with McDonald versus City of Chicago. And just say, you know what, you were a good fighter for the cause, and you know, I'm glad, you know, go off and enjoy your retirement. And unfortunately, that is just not going to be something I'm going to say with how he has been pushing forward. So, I mean, obviously, the last time we talked about it, we talked about Chris Cox essentially was discovered at being on par with us of going, yeah, no, Wayne needs to go. These improprieties that are being revealed are really bad news, and the Second Amendment is no longer his number one concern, and so really he needs to be let off to pasture, and new blood needs to come into place. And Wayne found out about it and terminated him from the group. And Chris Cox is no longer part of the NRA, which is really bad news as far as I'm concerned. I do really like Chris Cox. I have not heard anything bad about him in the entirety of me being aware of his career. And now it's gotten even worse, is that any board of director that has, or according to the letters that I've read, again, there's a whole lot of he said, she said, but a lot of members of the board of directors who have been vocal against Wayne LaPierre has suddenly found that their committees have been terminated.
Uh-huh.
And so it appears that
retaliation is, I think, the word of the day.
Yes. Yeah, he is stripping away all the people that are going through and essentially empowering himself and empowering the, let's just use the word sycophantic.
Ooh, that's a good word. Yes.
Yeah, and it's not a good word. I don't want to color code. Like the people that are sticking on and standing beside him are looking more and more disgusting to me. I was originally comfortable with people going, look, let's not turn against Wayne. He's been at the head of the group for so long and all that. And I can understand that. I absolutely can. That's not my feeling, but I can see the idea of we don't need to gut this organization. Let's just, you know, adjust course and fix a few things and see what we can do. And that's absolutely a very reasonable, it's a very conservative way of going about things. And but now it's really getting into this is rotten to the core, and you people are sticking around because there's something in it for you, or there's something not in it for you going against it. But yeah, so there's that, and then really the bigger one is that Jennifer Baker, who was the top communications aide for the NRA, she was terminated from the group, and now the communications operations of the NRA has been reorganized and essentially reports directly to Wayne LaPierre. And that really kind of made my blood run cold, because that is starting to say that essentially Wayne's declared himself God Emperor of the NRA. And my initial thought was, use the term cleansing fire, but we could also use the term surgical removal, is that we could excise the members that are not doing the correct things and not helping us out and making it so that, in theory, we had, you know, a Republican House and Senate that is, in theory, pro-gun. And we had a president who had aligned himself with the NRA and who was, in theory, pro-gun. And the NRA is the alleged 500-pound gorilla that, you know what, when we say what we want, you know what, people, we don't necessarily get exactly what we want, but boy, people listen. And what have we got from that? We've got a ban on bump stocks. We've got threats against suppressors. We've got just a bunch of just crap that is no bueno. And now on top of that, you've got Wayne LaPierre fortifying his position with the NRA. And I've been seeing it on Facebook. A couple of people have brought up, like, there are some, you know, gun people that are getting extra vocal against the NRA. And I guess I can actually see that. There's always been people that have been anti-NRA ever since I've got started. Is they are not the group that is, they don't pass the purity test. They're not Second Amendment enough. And they would prefer, you know, the actions of other Second Amendment groups. And honestly speaking, that's something I absolutely agree with to some extent. But I believe that the NRA has such a good infrastructure and such a good design and has such a high membership and such a wide appeal and has done so many good things that I really think that it's worth loving it, warts and all. So I was hoping that the NRA could be saved, and there might be, say, another Cincinnati revolt where, hey, guess what? We're going in the wrong direction. It's time to change course. You know, come with me, dear members of the NRA. And instead, it looks like, again, Wayne LaPierre was the vote of no confidence was struck down, quote unquote, unanimously. And immediately several boards of directors members have said, no, it was not unanimous. It was done through shenanigans. And that I am getting very, very concerned that the only way to end this completely horrible running of the group is to kill it. And I really don't want that to happen.
So here's some good news for people who are fans of Cam and Company. He's back. Now, I know that we mentioned a couple weeks ago that he was the editor for Bearing Arms, and that's still true. But now, in association with Bearing Arms, Cam is back on the air, sort of. Cam and Company is back, and it's being shown on YouTube for as long as YouTube will tolerate its presence, I guess. but he's back, and it's a one-man show, and I think it's only like 30 minutes or an hour, something like that. But I know this comes as great news to Weird because he said something to the effect of Cam has a great radio voice and it would be such a tragedy if he never spoke on the air again.
Yes, that is absolutely true.
So when are you going to interview him, by the way? I got you his contact information.
Yeah, well, I'm traveling. I was thinking about contacting him, but I think I'll wait till I get back and then let him know, because hey, I'm contacting you to let me know if I can interview you, but it's going to be a couple weeks. So that seems like a bit of a tease. So, but I'm definitely going to contact him and get him to plug the new show. And that's extra good, because I'm like, oh man, I'm going to interview him, but I wonder if he's not going to want me to talk about Cam and Company. But now... Now he is Cam and Company. Hooray! it's such happy news. It's such happy news. I mean, it's something he's done for so long, and he's so good at it. You can tell that he loves it. So it's awesome. There's nothing else I could say but awesome.
All right, so Weird, last week Egghead geeked out about the Therm flashlight ring. What does he have for us in Eggy goodness to geek out over this week?
He was lamenting that the Therm flashlight ring only fit a handful of flashlights, and none of the flashlights he had on hand fit it. So he knew he needed to get a new flashlight, but he needed to find just the right flashlight. And of course, we're talking about the just the right flashlight for him. And that turns out to be the Nightcore P12.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the General Purpose Egghead. This week, I'm doing another gear review, and this time a more detailed review of the Nightcore P12 flashlight. I came across this flashlight when I was searching for a flashlight that had both rechargeable batteries, some low power options that would be remembered when I turn the flashlight on so I don't blind myself with too much light at night, and a flashlight that would fit the Therm Switchback 2.0 flashlight ring that I reviewed last week. And this light does all of that and a little bit more. I feel it's very well designed. And I haven't really used Nightcore for any tactical accessories before, but they're pretty well known for making really good battery chargers, some really fancy portable USB battery banks, and they also make flashlights, but they don't have the same kind of a reputation as Streamlight or Surefire. And honestly, this flashlight feels like it might be making a difference in that regard. It feels very well constructed. As a company, they've been around a while. They're not really a Johnny-come-lately to the industry. I remember reading reviews of Nightcore flashlights on the random flashlight nerd blogs back in like 2009 or 2010, something along those lines. So they've been around a while. They know what they're doing. And their products seem to be very well made. So they might not have like a law enforcement pedigree, but I would absolutely trust this device. I mean, they care enough about it that they put a serial number on it. That's usually a good sign. So enough about the company. What about this light? So the Nightcore P12 is, I'd consider it a full-size flashlight. It's maybe 5.5 inches long. It's like 3/4 of an inch thick. You can fit it in a pocket, no problem. But it's definitely going to show, and it's not like the tiny little EDC flashlights that run off of a AA or a single CR123. It's a full-size light. Accordingly, it uses a full-size battery. You can put 2 CR123 flashlight batteries in there if you'd like. Those are just kind of the standard tactical flashlight battery. Or you can put a single 18650 lithium cell in it. These are the commonly used rechargeable lithium batteries that are all over the place used in e-cigarettes. There's probably not a corner of the country that you can't find one of these on the shelf within 25 miles of. So they're really common, they're all over the place, chargers are everywhere. One little caveat though, with this flashlight, you're probably going to want a protected lithium cell. That's one that has an extra circuit board on top of it that stops the cell from being discharged too low. If you discharge a lithium battery too low, it's actually dangerous. If you've heard stories of people's e-cigarettes catching fire in their pocket, that's the kind of thing that can happen if you abuse a lithium battery. In that case, it was because they probably drew way too much current way too quickly by accidentally activating the switch in their pocket and leaving it on. E-cigarettes aren't designed for that. You don't have to worry about that with a flashlight. They're not going to explode like that. But if you discharge the battery too low, the next time you try to charge it, you could have something like that. So get a protected cell. They're a little bit harder to find, but they're still out there. If you absolutely can't find one, there are some features to this flashlight that make it usable with non-protected cells. You just have to be a little more careful, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But the first question everybody wants to ask about a flashlight is, how bright is it? How many lumens? I want to know the lumens! Everyone likes to brag about how bright their light is. I think it's a little silly because above about 200, I don't feel like it really gets you much more practical use. It's a little bit more blinding, maybe, but 200 lumens to the face at night is still going to blind somebody. But this is a 1,000 lumen flashlight. That's nice. It's pretty respectable. And boy, it is bright. It'll light up the whole room. You point it at the ceiling, and it's like you just turned on the overhead light. The high mode is 1,000. It has a medium mode, which is 240 lumens, and it has a low mode that is 70 lumens. Even the low mode is fairly bright for indoors, just regular usable stuff, but the medium mode is probably about the happy medium that I like to use. Somewhere around 200 lumens feels about right for me. They also have an extra low mode that's really useful. They say it's 1 lumen. I feel like it's more like 10 or 15. It feels like it's as bright as my I've got one of those little Maglite 1 AAA cells on my keychain. It feels like it's about that bright. And it'll last forever in that low power mode. And it also, you know, doesn't wake the neighbors when I turn it on at night, which I really like. In addition to those four settings, it also has a couple of cool little other features. It has a strobe mode because everybody likes epilepsy. It's fantastic. It also has an SOS mode in case you ever need to spell out SOS with your flashlight. I guess that's kind of nice. And it has a location beacon mode. And this is one I haven't seen before. I could see a couple of limited situations in which it would be useful, and it doesn't really cost them anything else to put it in the flashlight, so I like it. If you put it in this location beacon mode, it will emit a very bright strobe flash once every 2 seconds, somewhere in that range. Like, if you ever played Call of Duty and you remember seeing the, like, the IR strobes, or like in Black Hawk Down where they got those IR strobes that just, like, flash and then pause and then flash and then pause and then flash, it's like that. And it's very bright. So if you leave it somewhere, it's going to be easy to find your way back to it. So I don't know, if you're leaving the campsite in the middle of the night to take a whiz and you want to make sure you don't get lost in the woods, you could leave this flashlight, like, at the tent. And then, you know, have your little pocket light that you carry out with you, and you'd be able to see quite a ways away through the woods where that flashlight is. So that's kind of neat. To cycle through the different modes of the flashlight, instead of using the tail cap switch like some other manufacturers do and having to do this elaborate tap dance Morse code on it to try and change things, here's looking at you, Streamlight. They gave you a separate button. It's a side switch button that's a little further forward on the light. So you can turn the light on with the tail cap and then press this button to cycle through the different modes. If you hold the button down, it'll go immediately to strobe, because if you're wanting to strobe somebody, you probably want it to happen quickly. And strobe is the only one of those special modes, the SOS or location beacon, where it'll remember when you turn the flashlight off, and then when you turn it back on, it'll go right back to that mode. Which brings me to another thing I like about this light, which is when you set it to a particular brightness setting, it remembers that and goes to that brightness setting immediately when it's turned on. So I can turn it to, like, medium, and then use it as a momentary flashlight that's 240 lumens. A lot of other lights won't do that. They'll just go immediately to the brightest setting or immediately to the lowest setting, whatever you program them for, but you can't set them for medium and just, like, leave them there. I'm sure putting some kind of circuit in there to make the flashlight remember what mode it's in consumes some tiny amount of current, but I've got a pretty big battery in there, and it's probably a very, very small amount of current. I'm not really worried about it. So I really like having that separate mode switch. It just feels much easier and more convenient to change between the different flashlight modes. But that's not the only thing I like about that extra button. It also does a couple of other things for you. It's got a little LED underneath the button. It lights up, and it kind of glows through the rubber of the switch. And when your flashlight is below 50% battery, it'll start to flash about once every 2 seconds, just giving you a heads up. Hey, charge me soon. Charge me soon. And then when you get to low battery, it'll start to strobe continuously, saying, all right, if you've got a non-protected cell, turn this thing off now. Otherwise, things are going to get hairy. So it doesn't cut out, but it'll at least warn you. So if you don't have a protected cell, you could use it that way and just be careful not to discharge it too much. I would feel a little uncertain about that. I'd be afraid I wouldn't notice it. But if the unprotected cell is all you happen to have, you could probably work with that. The last thing that that button does, and this is actually my favorite feature of the light, is if you hit the tail cap switch and the mode switch at the same time with a quick momentary press, before it powers on the flashlight, it'll let you know what your state of charge is. It'll flash out the voltage of the battery. So if your flashlight is around middle of the charge at like 3.8 or 3.7 volts, say it's 3.8, it'll flash 3 times, pause, and then flash 8 times. So you have to watch it for several seconds to see what your state of charge is, but it'll give you an actual voltage reading of the battery. And then you can say, okay, I'm above 3.8. I've probably got another day. Or if you flash it and it's like 3.2, you know you're pretty much dead. So it gives you like solid numbers on how charged your flashlight is. And I really appreciate that, especially as a battery nerd. So the specs seem nice. The software end of it and the different modes seem kind of nice. The physical construction of the flashlight is also very nice. It's all like aircraft grade aluminum. It seems pretty rugged. It's got some nice knurling on it so you can get a nice good grip. The switches all seem pretty decent. I don't have a lot of experience with that kind of thing, but they don't seem like they're going to come apart very soon. And they do come with a spare little rubber gasket for the tail cap switch. So if you wear that out, you can just disassemble the tail cap and put a new little rubber blocker in there. And off you go, which is probably important because the flashlight's also waterproof. They say it's submersible to 2 meters. I haven't tried it, but I believe them. Another thing I like is the tail cap. Instead of having a tail cap button that's completely unshrouded, where it might be accidentally turned on in a pocket, or one that's completely shrouded, where it might be a little bit more difficult to activate, you got to kind of activate it with the tip of your thumb. The tail cap is kind of U-shaped. There's two protrusions that try and protect the light against accidental activation, but they're on opposite sides of the light, and they only cover, you know, less than a quarter of the light on each side. So if you look at it from the side, the button is totally exposed. If you rotate it 90 degrees, the button is totally covered. So that's kind of nice, especially if you use it with the switchback flashlight ring, because that means that there's this nice little channel that your middle finger can fit into. It's almost like they were designed to work together. I kind of wonder if they might have been. But I really liked that feature, especially with the switchback flashlight ring. Oh, and you can tail stand that flashlight, so you can sit it on the switch and point it up at the ceiling, and it'll illuminate an entire ring. Some flashlights you can't do that with. I like that feature, especially in like a power outage. If I just want to like walk around the room and do things, I can flip my light on, set it down, and off I go. The battery life on it also seems pretty dang decent. In the super low power mode, it'll last for 520 hours, which is pretty good. In the high power mode, it's going to run dead in just hour 15 or something like that is what they say. But if you're putting out 1,000 lumens, your battery's not going to last long. Sorry, it's just the way it is. But the medium power mode, 240 lumens, has a pretty respectable runtime. They're quoting 26 hours. So a little over a complete day of kicking out 240 lumens. So it's pretty efficient, and I don't feel like I have to charge it up all the time. I haven't used it a ton, but I've done a little bit of stress testing on it, left it on for a little bit. It seems to hold up pretty well, and it doesn't feel like it sucks through batteries. And even if it did, they're rechargeable. Once you buy one, it doesn't really cost you anything to use it for quite a while. So it's not really a big deal. Overall, I really like this flashlight. If you could put it in a shrink ray and make it about two-thirds the size and make it take a AA, I'd like it even more, even if it put out a lot less power. But then it wouldn't fit the switchback. And at that point, I'm kind of describing my other EDC light, which is the Streamlight ProTac 1L1AA. Sometime I might give a review of that too, but that would be for another day. That's it for this week, guys. Hope it was useful to you. I'll see you later. Stay safe and be smart.
Okay, so, I mean, I get that it's a nice flashlight. I have never heard anyone geek out quite so much about a flashlight. I've had to do flashlight reviews, and honestly, I struggle to do more than it came on when I pressed the button. It's bright enough. It takes this kind of battery. What more do you want from me?
I love the when he was talking about the voltage numbers and that, and talking about the fact that it flashes the exact voltage number. Cause, I'm trying to remember if it got into a blooper reel or not, but, I remember we were talking to him at the start of a, mag dump, and he was like, all right, you're way too quiet. Can you dial up the gain on your microphone a little bit? And he's like, how many decibels do you need it to be? And he wanted the exact decibel number because he could dial it in. Because the dials were numerical. And so That is exactly how he rolls. Also, I wanted to point out with the signal feature on that. I can assume since it's like an EDC flashlight. Oh yeah, no, he did say it was waterproof. That is a feature that is on just about all like marine survival gear, like life rafts and survival suits and life jackets and all that. A lot of them come with strobe lights, and often strobe lights that are water activated. So as soon as they get wet, they turn on and start flashing. And the whole idea of the pulsing white light is so that A, rescue crews can find you. There's something for them to see in, you know, a dark and stormy night, but also so you can see other people. Mm-hmm. One of the things they teach you for if you are in the water, either in a survival suit or in a life jacket, is to get everyone together and then use all the buckles and straps and things that are attached to the gear to lash yourselves all together, so that number one, people aren't going to get lost and separated, but also it makes you a bigger target for whoever's trying to find you.
So Oddball has been talking a lot about knives, and I'm sure some of our listeners are wondering, well, what else about knives could he talk about? Surely he's talked about everything. And, well, he's talked about the blades, but not so much about the handles.
Welcome to Oddball's Corner Pocket. The other day, I made the realization that I've talked a lot about the blade of the knife, but really nothing about the handle material. Since that's the part of the knife that you actually hold while using it, it is kind of important. So, I thought I'd talk about it today. On the cheaper end of things are plastic handles. For the most part, I feel the same about plastic as I do about blade metals. If they don't tell you what kind of plastic it is, it's probably because it's junk. You can find all sorts of mall ninja knives, like the one Panya lamented me purchasing in episode 51, that use cheap plastic for their handle scales. Generally, it's the sign of a cheap knife to avoid. Of course, the exception to my feelings about plastic handles are kitchen knives. There are a good number of professional-end kitchen knives that use nondescript plastic. It honestly doesn't require that good of a plastic to hold up to a kitchen environment. As long as the plastic doesn't need to add structural rigidity, it should be fine. The next step up on the list is fiberglass reinforced nylon. FRN is still pretty cheap to produce, but is fairly rigid and holds up to wear pretty well. I believe that most of the plastic rifle stocks out there are made of this material. While most FRN-handled knives will have steel reinforcements, some, like the lightweight versions of many Spyderco knives, are just made of this material. The knife handles without the steel reinforcements do flex, but are still pretty resilient to abuse. Finally, when talking about polymers, there's G10. G10 is very rigid. To give you an idea, it's originally designed to be used for circuitry boards, if you've ever handled those. And it is the go-to for higher-end knives that use plastic for handle scales. The biggest issue with G10 is that rigidity also means it's pretty brittle. This means that you're not going to see quite as aggressive texturing as you would with, say, FRN. You'll also see a lot of knives with metal handles. The most common are probably aluminum, steel, and titanium. For the most part, I see these materials as mainly being used for decorative purposes, more than practical reasons. Aluminum, being the cheapest and softest, is often used for scales, but will pretty much always have steel inserts. I've seen a number of designs, like the CRKT Crossbones, press or mold a design into the aluminum and put a color coating on it. Unfortunately, it, being as soft as it is, can get scratched up pretty quickly, and the coating will wear off. Both steel and titanium are often used when the designer wants as few pieces in the handles as possible. Both metals are strong enough to be used as the lock in the frame lock, and I've seen where some designers have actually milled out the handle out of a single piece instead of assembling multiple pieces. Of course, they do have their downsides. Steel is heavy, and titanium, while light, is expensive. Also, in general, the knives that I've seen using these materials for handles are slick and hard to hold on to. I have to admit that I honestly don't know if there's a reason why you don't see the kind of checkering in steel-scaled knives that you see on the front strap of, say, a 1911. Brass and copper are also currently popular in the custom knife world. They have the appeal that they age quickly without rusting like high-carbon steel would. This can give a knife a really cool, unique look. Unfortunately, they seem to combine the flaws of steel and titanium, and are both expensive and heavy. Of course, if you're wanting to drop some money on some bling, there are folks that will make knives for you with metals like gold. If you're going to carry such things in your pocket, just remember how soft gold is, and of course, make sure you won't cry too much if it falls out of your pocket and gets lost. Speaking of expensive materials, there's always carbon fiber. I have to admit that I really like carbon fiber as a handle material. It's pretty and can be polished to a high shine like the TCK I reviewed in episode 61, or left rough like the Spyderco Smock. In both cases, the way it picks up the light is really neat. The final category I'm going to talk about are more natural materials. Companies like Case still make knives with bone handles. There's a reason why bone has been used as handle material for thousands of years. It can be dyed to an extent and is fairly resilient to day-to-day abuses. That said, it can shatter under heavy usage, and it tends to be a bit slick. If you're wanting a fixed-blade knife with a decent grip to the handle, leather is always an excellent material. Generally, the leather is either wrapped like a cord or stacked. The downside is that it can rot in humid climates. Somewhere in between is wood. Of course, I could spend a few segments on the different types of wood out there, and folks that know more than me could go on for hours, but I'll try to speak in generalities. Wood does need regular maintenance, but can be used for some beautiful knife handles. If you want to really keep that wood looking nice, you'll want to preserve it somehow. While you may run into lacquered wood handles or other coatings, stabilized wood has become common. Stabilized wood is basically wood impregnated with something like epoxy. The end product is something that has the look of the wood, but very resilient to wear and won't dry out, crack, etc. If made right, it can even retain the feel of the wood as well. Micarta is made in a similar fashion. They take layers of cloth, soak them in epoxy, and press them together. The end product is something that looks and feels like the cloth that was used, but is stiff enough to make handle scales out of. The couple examples I have provide excellent grip, even when wet. Oh, and you will run into knives that simply have their handles wrapped in paracord. Oftentimes, the manufacturer will make the statement that you can use the paracord in a survival situation. While this is technically true, I don't think I would count on it. Paracord can make a very functional handle covering, but frankly, it always seems cheap to me, especially on the $300 survival knives I've seen where it seems that they just called it in when it came to the handle material. I hope that this was informative. If you want to read more of my thoughts, I write at gunscarstech.com. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts about future segments, I can be reached at oddball@gunscarstech.com or on the ACP Facebook group. Until next time, have a good one.
So, Aaron, what is your favorite knife handle material? Do you have a favorite?
I don't think I'm really that much of a knife aficionado to have a favorite, because that would indicate I've tried them all and have strong opinions on all of them, and I don't really. But one thing I can tell you is that I have a very, very nice knife from Firehand. He's a blogger that hopefully some of you know about, and he has that moniker because... Well, before he retired due to health issues, he was a blacksmith.
Ooh.
And he sent me a knife. And it was just completely unexpected. I mean, it was just a package that showed up on my door about 4 years ago. And the enclosed note said, "Hey, Aaron, this is one of the pieces left when I had to stop forging. Thought you might like it." And so I'm not really sure what style it is, other than it's nice. It's pretty. The blade length is 10 1/4 inches long. The overall length is 15.75. The handle is bone with brass caps, and it came with a matching custom leather sheath that I thought looked hand-stitched. And so, you know, if you know how much handmade knives are worth, you can get the idea of what kind of a gift this is. It's really, really lovely. And so I asked him about it, and so the handle, he says it's from Sambar Stag in mm-hmm. India, and so it's bone, but it looks like it's antler from a white-tailed mm-hmm. deer, but unlike antler, it's solid all the way through. So you get the best of both worlds. It looks pretty like antler, but it's as strong like bone, and so you don't have to worry about the tang rattling around inside. And the steel is 5160 spring steel. And 5160, to give you an idea of its strength, it's what leaf springs are made from.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are aficionado of the Gurkhas, they forge their kukris from leaf springs of 2.5-ton trucks. So leaf spring steel, it has a real good pedigree. And so that is my favorite knife. Well, just for sentimental reasons, I mean, it's beautiful. He gave it to me. I couldn't put a price tag on it, but also it's really well made. It's just beautiful. To be honest, I haven't used it yet because I don't want to damage it. But I know that if I need to, it will hold up really well. It's in my bug out bag.
Yeah. Well, all of those things together, you're going to have to, I mean, again, there's a difference between using it hard and abusing it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I would say that I would not be, I would be afraid to abuse it only because of the brass fittings, and you might chip the bone mm-hmm. and all that. Though overall, I would suspect that that design would hold up pretty well, even to abuse. Yeah. It just would not stay as pretty, but mm-hmm. hard use, I don't think is going to hurt it that much, especially since you do know how to resharpen. So that's really the only thing that's going to suffer is the edge will go from razor sharp, which I'm sure it is, to just mama's kitchen knife.
Not my mama's. Oh my God. She's so terrible.
Oh yeah. No,
That's another story. So, all right, so you were asking me, I'm going to ask you the same question. What is your favorite knife handle material?
Well, I would say probably overall, I'm fine with just so long as it's comfortable and feels good in my hands, I'm fine with any of the materials out there. Though, if I had to have a choice, I really like micarta. I really like the feel of it. I like the fact that it's very grippy. It's very shapeable. It's got a very attractive kind of grain to it. So it's got kind of a little bit of the looks of wood, but at the same time is very, very tough and very durable. And you don't have to worry about essentially a lot of the issues that Oddball mentioned with wood. I do like wood. I do like really, really nice. I have a friend. Well, he's since passed away, but he was a knife maker. And he was from India, and so he definitely talked about Sambar Stag a lot, and I think I have a piece that's made from his collection that's made with that as well, but he specifically got me hooked on Amboina Burl, which if Oddball's going to do a wood segment, that would definitely be something that he definitely needs to mention. I think he would no matter what, because it's very, very popular for all sorts of different handles and other useful things. It's a very, very oily wood, and it works very, very well, and it's very pretty. But also, I wanted to bring up that Oddballs talks about, like, yeah, kitchen knives, just using just plastic is, there's another reason for that. I mean, number one, yeah, they can hold up to not being great, you know, the greatest plastic on earth, because you might be abusing the blade a little bit if you're, you know, say, you know, using it as a meat cleaver and trying to chop up a chicken or something like that. But you're really not going to be batoning firewood like you would with, like, say, a survival knife. So the idea of splitting the cheap plastic handle is probably not going to happen in the kitchen. But one of the big things is, again, if you're chopping up a chicken, you do not want those chicken juices and potentially the risk of salmonella that might be in that to be soaking into your knife handle. And so one reason, actually, I think restaurants require plastic knife handles for all knives being used, so that they can be easily sterilized
by putting them in the dishwasher.
No, I think they use for the knife. I think they use a disinfecting solution for the, because a lot of these knives with cheap handles have very, very expensive blades.
Oh,
definitely.
Okay.
The cutlery, all the, like the your steak knives and your butter knives and the knives that the customers are allowed to touch. Yeah, those go right into the dishwasher. But you don't want to be putting a knife that's being used to do any sort of precision cutting in a dishwasher, just because there's abrasives in dishwasher detergent, and that'll just completely sandblast your edge.
So, Weird, I want to thank you, because when I saw you had a Fisk and you had a Fisk of David Hogg, my reaction was, oh, God, no, not today. Not right now. I can't take this. And I was very upset, and I was bracing myself. And then I see that wasn't for today. It'll probably be for next week or whatever. But now you've got an interview with someone cool. And that makes me a lot happier. So tell me about this really cool person you're interviewing.
So the person I met was, again, at the NRA fashion show. It seems like that was a really good event to go to. I had so much fun there, and I met a ton of people. And this guy is Jake Skillett, and he runs Von Bern Dog Training in Indiana. And I was like, oh, my God, I have to have you on the show. We talk about why in the interview. So let's just dive right into it. So another person that I met at the NRA Concealed Carry Fashion Show was this gentleman, Jake Skillett, and he brought with him his dog, and he really made quite an impression on the show. How you doing, Jake?
Just fine. How are you?
So what's the name of your the business that you run?
So it's called Von Bern Canine Training Center, and it's located in Brownsburg, Indiana, which is just right outside of Indianapolis.
So I just led into it. Do you want to talk about your appearance at the fashion show?
Yeah, for sure. So we were approached by Miss Hiding Hilda herself, Dawn. Don reached out to us for wanting to kind of add a new kind of flair to the show, more than just, you know, the purses and those types of things. And also, you know, wanted to kind of show another element of personal protection. So had us come out. It was a fun show. First Lady of Indiana was there, which is pretty cool. Janice Holcomb, got to snap a picture with her and Titus and my wife as well. So basically we had a booth up there as well, so we could answer questions and whatnot. But, we were, I think, seventh in line. I was hiding in the back actually with you, 'cause you were running audio. You're the man of the hour when it comes to that kind of stuff. So waiting in the back and, you know, jumped out and cracked the whip a couple times, and we kind of showed the instance of those fatal few seconds where she was able to deploy the dog and then draw her firearm and hold me down. So it worked out real well.
Yeah, you were playing the part of a mugger on your wife, who is a lady out walking her dog with her concealed carry firearm. And
for sure,
let me tell you, there was not anybody in that entire auditorium that expected that to happen. there was a whole lot of oohs and ahs, and I just had a little window that I could peek out at, and all I saw was jaws on the floor. It was a good show.
Yeah,
you had your dog Titus. What breed is he?
So he's a Cane Corso, which is the Italian Mastiff. He'll be 4 in July, and he's about 110, 115 pounds. Obviously super social. You got to meet him. He's super sweet. Everybody can love on him, but when it comes to getting down and dirty, when it's, you know, that right time, he gets that job done as well.
Yeah, and so your school, it does both the standard obedience training and things that pretty much everyone thinks about with an obedience things, but
for sure.
you also do training for more specialized dog training?
For sure, yeah. Yeah, so we do, you know, a little bit of everything. We do, like you said, the obedience. One thing that kind of sets us apart from everybody else is all of our training is all one-on-one. So when somebody comes to us, it's just me and you and your dog in the room. We don't pack in a big class or something of that nature. It's really important to me. I want to be able to give you all my attention. And then also, when it comes down to that, there's always a problem child in the mix, and somebody, you know, whether you're the problem child or not, it still sucks to be in that position. And, you know, I want to make sure everybody gets the right amount of time. But with that being said, we also offer personal protection training, like what you saw with Titus. And then we do scent work as well. So, like I have a little beagle, that does bed bug detection going into hotels, nursing homes, etc.
Oh, that's awesome. I had actually never heard of that, but that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, so they use their nose, obviously, to find them. So it's non-invasive versus, you know, sometimes when we call the exterminator out, they're taking apart things on your wall, they're taking apart your couch, etc., looking for them. With the dog, we don't have to take apart anything. If they're there, the dog's going to be able to smell through, you know, the couch to, you know, be able to find them. Or for that matter, like I have little vials of live bed bugs, and I'll hide that little vial in a light switch and then put the cover back on. So it looks like nothing's affected by it. And the dog still indicates and finds them. So.
Well, that's cool. That is really cool. So given that we're a Second Amendment podcast, I kind of, you got me thinking about, especially at the Concealed Carry Fashion Show, on how essentially, I mean, the Second Amendment, we talk about knife rights and other stuff. It's not all about firearms.
Sure.
And
yeah.
Absolutely, I could see that that a well-trained canine can absolutely be a defensive tool.
You're exactly right. You know, I was tagged in a post on Facebook, and it showed a footprints of a canine of some sort, and it showed a footprints of human footprints in a cave, and somehow science proves it dated back to like 10,000 BC. Mm-hmm. So what that tells us is that we've been using dogs, or, you know, the canine species, for something pretty well since the beginning of man. Once we were able to catch one and kind of tame it down a little bit, you know, a wolf, and, you know, kind of go from there. We've been using these dogs for eons to be able to do that. So whether it's protecting your livestock or helping you hunt or whatever it may be, but, you know, with my specializing and the personal protection aspect, obviously I'm pro Second Amendment myself, you know, pro gun through and through. Concealed carry man, NRA man, the whole nine yards. But at the end of the day, my gun doesn't wake me up in the middle of the night and says, "Hey, Dad, somebody's out there. You need to go check it out." Or is raising a ruckus when somebody steps on my property, or when somebody knocks on my door. You know, if I was to instantly pull out a gun, there might be some issues there. But that first line of defense is huge. You know, even like an alarm system is a great system to have, yes, but all the bad guys know they at least have X amount of time, depending if you live out in the city or if you live out in the country, it's even more obviously before the cops show up. So they're, you know, if they stake out your place and do their homework proper, they're able to still get in, get what they want and get the hell out of there versus, and cameras for that matter, there's, you know, tons of police departments out there that say, well, we don't know what color he is. We don't even know if it's a male or a female. We don't even know if he has any tattoos because the man wore a hoodie with a mask and, you know, pants. And so, he was wearing a black hoodie with a black mask and black pants and black shoes. And that's about all they have. So, that dog is that kind of first line of defense for your home. Obviously there's nothing out there that is 100% foolproof. Mm-hmm. You know, the dogs have a mind of their own. Dogs don't look at certain situations and reason. Dogs, you know, are reactive. But when it boils down to it, that first line of defense able to, you know, let me know there's something out there so I can, you know, grab my firearm or grab, you know, whatever's closest to me, which hopefully is a firearm, and be able to, you know, address the situation and make that final decision, whether it's, does it need a firearm or does it need, you know, just, oh, hey, it's just a raccoon out front, you know, playing in the yard kind of thing. But I'd much rather be aware of it and, you know, have something and not need it versus not have it and need it. So.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, certainly they experience the world vastly different with their,
for sure,
their extra, yeah, sensitive ears and their nose and all that. I actually, a friend of mine actually had an instance where he was sitting down having dinner and suddenly his dog started going berserk. And it turned out the something went wrong with the electrical system in his car and it shorted out and there was a fire that had started.
Wow.
And
yeah,
he wouldn't have even thought to look at it until the fire was so bad. I don't know how close he was to his house, if it would have caught to the house as well, but he ended up being able to save the car thanks to his dog's alerting.
That's amazing.
And certainly they can probably get the idea of, I mean, probably just being able to smell the adrenaline of somebody getting, mm-hmm, ready to do something horrible as they ring your doorbell
for
might
sure
be enough for them to go, all right, I know they just rang the doorbell and that doorbell rings all the time, but this is not like those other times.
You're exactly right. And, you know, one of the things too that we look at when it comes to that is, you know, at the end of the day, you fight like a train, whether you own firearms, knives, whatever it may be, you need to be well versed in them. You know, like I have women approach me all the time. They're like, hey, I'm thinking about getting a firearm, or I'm thinking about, you know, maybe I'm not comfortable with a firearm, so I'm thinking about getting mace, or I'm thinking about, you know, a taser, whatever it may be. And those are all great tools in their own right. And same thing with a dog, you know, I can't take a dog in necessarily everywhere either, you know, but, at the end of the day, when we talk about those things, being well versed in them and knowing how they operate, you know, if they're interested in mace, I tell them, go do your research. A, B, buy two, right? So the first one, all I want you to do is go out there and spray it, right? Go outside where you're going to normally use it. You're not going to go spray it somewhere inside a barn or something like that. You're going to spray that outside and know what the wind's doing, understand how that works. And then also, you know, get a little bit on the end of your finger, not a whole bunch, but dab it underneath your eyes so you know what it feels like. Because the bad part about chemical agents is a lot of times it's going to come back on you too. So you have to be able to work through those things. Mm-hmm. Also with, you know, a taser. Tasers are fantastic tools, but it may not work on everybody. You know, my background is law enforcement and those types of things. And there's been a handful of times where we've hit people with tasers and they pull them out and look at you like, try something else, 'cause that didn't work, you know? Mm-hmm. So, chemical agents are the same way, you know, like mace and those things. It only works on, I think it's like 60 to 80% of the population. Other people, it, you know, the rest of them, it doesn't affect. So there's, once again, nothing foolproof, but when we talk about somebody knocking on the door, I have my clients, I tell them, I say, act like you don't have any control over that dog, because that's one more thing mentally that those people are like, oh, shit, Sue, I don't know if I want to mess with this, you know, whole situation. But 9 times out of 10, when somebody even just hears the dog bark, whether the dog's fully trained or not, they're going to back off. Working in a jail, working with all those criminals, obviously, because you're in a jail, the guys would talk about, you know, breaking into homes and things. And one of the big parts about that was, you know, if you had a dog in your house, we'll go to hit your neighbors. We're not going to go mess with you, you know. So that's in itself is just the deterrence factor is, yeah. is huge, you know. Really, you know, the deterrence is really what we look at when we look at a personal protection dog. I hope to God my dog never has to bite somebody. I really do. You know, it's the same thing when I buy a firearm. I don't pick it up and go, oh, hell, I can't wait to blow a hole in somebody. And if you do, you need to sell it. You don't need to own firearms, right? There's a handful of, you know, there's people in this world that really just don't need to own one. And it, and if you have that kind of attitude, you definitely don't. But, you know, you hope to God you never have to use it in that capacity. But, A, I'm going to train for it because, you know, in this world, especially nowadays that we live in, you never know what's going to come your way. And, B, I'd much rather have something and not need it versus need it and not have it.
Yep. So, as far as what dogs are, breeds, ages, are suitable for defensive training, and are there some that are excluded? I've got to assume that. Well, can you teach, if I've got a Chihuahua, can you teach it, or a Morkie? Can you teach it? Yeah. Can you teach those defensive skills?
So, believe it or not, you can. Right, the amount of strength and those types of things behind it mm-hmm. is a whole different ball game. You know, how practical is it? You know, like once again, my guy, he weighs about 110, 115 pounds. And he's solid muscle. When he hits you, it's like getting hit by a freight train. A dog like that is very practical in its own right for certain things, right? We're not going to put a dog like that necessarily on a police department because, you know, tracking after a bad guy or having to pick a big guy up like that and over your head and stick him in an attic is not very practical. We're going to pick a dog like, I also have a Belgian Malinois, and we're going to pick a dog like that, that, you know, he's about 65, 70 pounds. And he, you know, in the industry, we call them alligators or fur missiles, right? Where I'm able to pick a dog like that up and throw him over a 6-8 foot fence, no problem. For that matter, he can pretty well clear one by himself and doesn't need my help. Or jumping through a window or picking him up and putting him in a window for a building search. So every dog has a purpose. But when it comes to, you know, the personal protection aspect, I like the Corsos. You know, there's some trainers that say, oh, hell, I'd rather have a Shepherd or a Mal or, you know, whatever it may be. Believe it or not, right now in training, I have a Blue Heeler that I'm doing training with for personal protection, and she's knocking it out of the park. She weighs about, oh, I don't know, 45, maybe 50 pounds, and she's just knocking it out of the park. So to pick one breed, I don't think, you know, there's one specific breed. The practicality of some of the smaller guys, probably not so much.
But can you teach them to be better at alerting and things like that?
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you could definitely teach them, you know, hey, bark when somebody's, you know, pulling in the driveway or something of that nature. Typically, the little dogs have it down pat. Yeah. There was a study, and they, I think it was on like 60 Minutes or something of that nature. And they had a video of, they had three people. And they all had different breeds of dogs. One, you know, one lady had a lab. The other had a, I think it was a pit bull. And then the other ones had two little ankle biters. Whoa. It was like a Chihuahua and say Shih Tzu for lack of knowledge there. All three owners agreed that I know for sure that my dog's going to protect me. And I get that a lot, right? I get people that say, we don't need that kind of training because I know my dog will perform. And maybe, maybe not. But A, I don't want to take the chance. I like the peace of mind, you know, when I travel for work and that kind of stuff. And I don't have a dog with me. Titus is hanging out with my wife, and I know for without a shadow of a doubt, he's going to do whatever it takes to get the job done to protect her and all the assets in the house and within the family. And that's, you know, that helps me sleep better at night and all those things as well. So going back to that study, what ended up happening was they had a guy in a bite suit and he broke in to each of their homes and broke into the lab's house and attacked the owner that was sitting on the couch. Owner was screaming this, that, the other thing. Lab comes running in, looks at it and goes, I'm out, and runs away. Right. The pit bull, same thing. A guy comes in cracking a whip and hooping and hollering, attacks the owner. Dog kind of runs up and barks a little bit and was just like, I'm out of here too. So Doug took off and ran away. I think ended up hiding underneath the bed upstairs in the owner's house or something of that nature. Believe it or not, the two ankle biters were the only ones that engaged and actually bit the guy on the leg, and the guy ran out of the house. So with that being said, that kind of covers even, you know, that first little part of it. Could you train a little ankle biter to do it? Yes, the practicality of it, not so much, you know. If, you know, Chihuahua's really biting on your ankle and, you know, you rear back and kick it one good time, he's going to go flying across the room, you know. So the practicality in that nature, probably, you know, you're not going to utilize a dog like that. But it just kind of goes to show, once again, you fight like you train. So if the dog, especially the pit bull, if a dog like that was exposed to, these are the things I want you to do if X, Y, and Z happens, that dog's able to jump in there and get the job done for sure.
Well, that is awesome. And it was absolutely cool talking to you about all of that. And it definitely gives you a little bit more to think about, especially on the Second Amendment angle, that it's not necessarily all about guns. So
yeah.
Thanks for being on the show. And
you bet.
That is Jake Skillett of, what is it, Von?
Von Bern Canine Training Center.
All right. What town is that in?
It's in Brownsburg, Indiana.
Awesome. I'll leave a link to your website in the show notes. Thanks All right. so much for being on, Jake.
You bet. I appreciate you.
So I definitely remember the dog. I mean, who wouldn't? But I didn't remember him at all. Well, I mean, I remember him as the dog's chew toy, but I don't think I ever learned his name. That's awful.
Well, he was sitting in his booth at the front of the show, and then for the entirety of the fashion show, he was on the exact other side. It was not like I saw any of your great stories of the models psyching themselves up for that during the show, because I was off in the audio booth and he again was tucked up off to the side, so that he was just sitting there and we were just sitting back talking about he was interested in podcasts and things like that, and then suddenly he's like, oh, it's time for me to go, and then he put on his big heavy suit so that his gigantic dog could chew on him. But yeah, that was everyone was just so surprised to suddenly see this big beautiful dog, and everyone's like, "Ooh, oh, he's so cute, look at him," because he's a gorgeous dog. And then all of a sudden those ears slick back and the growling happens, and suddenly it's like, the oh my god, this is actually happening. It was,
yeah, and that dog was loud too. Woof.
I mean, he's as big as a small person. I mean, that is, it was a, I mean, it's just a, it's a mastiff, and so it was a just a massive dog. So
I mean, I think the dog has a deeper voice than
yeah.
you do.
Oh, easily. Easily. And so yeah, no, I was glad to have Jake on, and I was also glad to hear that he said a cuss word during the interview and then later mentioned the breed Shih Tzu. And so I'm like, oh, I'm totally using that.
Oh, see, you edited that so smoothly. I thought he did it deliberately. And I was so impressed. It's like, that is the slickest thing I have ever heard. Such a good recovery.
I've always been making jokes about that. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump. You can hear more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can get more from me at my nerd blog, Lurking Rhythmically, at my prepping blog, Blue Collar Prepping. And, of course, you can keep track of what's going on with the development of my various charities and nonprofits at pinkpistols.org and blazingsword.org.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
Well, for about the next month, This is neither his circus nor his monkeys. They're mine. So our podcast editing styles are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.